Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Drone killings are suddenly getting the debate the airing they've probably deserved for a while. CIA nominee John Brennan, before a Senate committee last week, a leaked white paper lays out the Obama administration's legal rationale, even for strikes on American citizens. There's a lot of language, and there's a threat out there, but does it really sound legal, ethical, in line with the world we'd like to see? This hour on Point, American values, American law, and death by drone. You can join the conversation, how should this weapon be used or not used on Americans, on anyone, under law? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Special welcome today to listeners on the new 92.7 WBUA on Martha's Vineyard, out on out to Cape Cod, the islands, and the snowy coast. We are glad you're here. Later this hour, we'll look at the surprise announcement out of Rome today that Pope Benedict will retire at the end of this month. First living pope to step down in centuries. But first, to drones, American policy and the law. Joining me first from Washington is Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Julian Barnes, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me here, Tom.
Well, that was some blow-up of this debate last week. Do you think it's going to change the legal parameters around the use of American drones?
Well, we're certainly going to have a debate now for basically the first time to have a real open discussion. The nomination of John Brennan has opened up a number of fronts, from, you know, drone courts to, you know, whether this should be a CIA or a military program. All of a sudden, it's a much more public discussion.
Clearly, we've got some contradictions to work out here. John Brennan, up for director of the CIA before the Senate committee last week. And here he was, I'm sure you heard this, Julian, saying what we need here is to optimize transparency and to optimize secrecy. Tough to do at the same time. Here's Brennan.
I have been a strong proponent of trying to be as open as possible with these programs as far as our explaining what we're doing. What we need to do is optimize transparency on these issues, but at the same time, optimize secrecy and the protection of our national security.
What has that meant in practice, Julian? Optimizing transparency, i.e. openness, and secrecy at the same time?
Well, in practice, it's meant we have this open secret about the drone strikes that are discussed but not discussed. Listen, Brennan has been out front delivering several speeches supporting other Obama administration officials to give speeches on outlining the parameters of how they use this. Yet, they never come out and say the CIA uses drones to strike at militants. They always keep it vague, which is frustrating since we know it. U.S. officials speak on background about it. And so that's why we have this strange dance between sort of public acknowledgement and then this sort of shroud of secrecy. But as Senator Feinstein mentioned last week, you know, the idea that this is a covert program is kind of wearing thin now. It's very difficult. It's becoming increasingly difficult to justify given all of the public discussions of this. And so maybe there needs to be a rebalance of what's secret and what's transparent.
And also something around the legal rationale and making it very clear. I mean, she and others have been now calling for a new court to oversee perhaps the use of drones before they go down for the kill. What's that call, Julian?
Well, this is being modeled on, you know, the FISA courts, the ones, the court, national security courts that allow the government to do warrants to listen to calls. They're secret courts. They're outside the normal structure, and it's quite controversial. Apparently, the Obama administration has been discussing this internally, which we learned through this hearing. And in the days since the hearing, there's been a lively discussion among the legal community about whether this could work, whether you could say bring bring the evidence to this court and say the president wants to do a drone strike on this person. there's all kinds of practical problems there. The Obama administration is likely to oppose it. But on the other hand, it seems quite odd that you need a warrant to listen to someone's phone calls, but you don't to kill them.
Even an American citizen. And now, we know sometimes these decisions, I suppose, get made very fast, in a hurry. On the other hand, this white paper that was leaked last week, a kind of summary, it seems, of a bigger legal rationale, puts an awful lot of power in the hands of what senior officials who were told know what they're doing, and so they can order the kill.
Yeah, I mean, John Brennan, Eric Holder have outlined some of this legal process before in a series of speeches they've done in recent years. This white paper adds a little bit to our knowledge, particularly on what they might define as an imminent threat. And, you know, critics of the paper have said the imminent threat is being defined very expansively, which means there might be some room for a review of a decision before the trigger is pulled.
I mean, the president himself, there hasn't been much explicit discussion of this. John Brennan did not use the word drone in his testimony. The president himself, though, talked about it last fall on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He talked about the need for rules and a legal framework for drone strikes. Here's the president.
One of the things that we've got to do is put a legal architecture in place, and we need congressional help to do that, to make sure that not only am I reined in, but any president's reined in terms of some of the decisions that we're making.
Well, there's the president saying we need it, but the appetite for it has been pretty patchy. Julian Barnes with The Wall Street Journal, it's great to have you here. Please stand by. Joining us now as well from New York City is Matthew Waxman, professor of law, co-chair of the program on law and national security at Columbia University, fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served in senior positions at the U.S. State Department, Defense, and National Security Council under the George W. Bush administration. Matthew Waxman, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from New York is Jamil Jaffer. He's director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Center for Democracy. In 2004, he litigated the first successful constitutional challenge to the U.S. Patriot Act. Through the ACLU, he and others have been pushing the government to release its justification, its legal rationale, for the drone strike which killed American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen in 2011. Jamil Jaffer, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
Do we have anything like an appropriate legal framework for what's going on, Jamil?
No, not at all. We have right now, you know, a kind of sketchy sense of what the administration has adopted as a legal framework, and we have enough information now, I think, to be able to say that particular framework doesn't match what international law or domestic law actually require. In particular, the administration seems to be taking the position that they have the authority to use lethal force far away from actual battlefields against people who don't present truly imminent threats. The white paper uses the language of imminence, but it redefines the term imminence. Their definition really has no bearing to the definition that you find in a dictionary. There's no requirement of an immediate threat. There's no requirement of a specific ongoing plot. And so what the administration is really claiming is the authority to use lethal force without judicial review, either before the fact or after the fact, against people who present in the conclusion of an informed high-level official who present continuing threats to the country. And that's actually a very broad power that they're claiming. It's much broader than what international law allows and much broader than what the Constitution allows.
Matthew Waxman, I wonder if, I mean, you were there in the Bush administration when there was a firestorm of criticism for extra-legal measures at that time, from interrogation measures and even the beginnings of the drone program. That drone program has ramped up very dramatically under the Obama administration without very much complaint about it or even tough probing. Is that an irony to you, Matthew Waxman? Is it appropriate what's happened?
Well, I think there is some irony in the sense that I think the targeted killing program rests on some very similar I say similar, not identical, but similar legal bases to many of the Bush administration's most controversial policies and practices. I've described the recent Justice Department white paper, though, as more narrow than the Bush administration's positions on some similar legal issues. And what I mean by that is, first of all, I think it's a reasonable interpretation of the law as that law stands now. It's confined to a specific set of circumstances. It doesn't adopt some of the most sweeping alternative legal formulations that some, including some former Bush administration lawyers, have pushed for, such as the idea that an enemy al-Qaeda fighter has no constitutional rights, that the president's discretion to use lethal force is totally unlimited, or that congressional restrictions, such as the type that Mr. Barnes was describing, would be unconstitutionally void. Now, does it still leave some big questions and concerns in my mind? Yes, and I think it requires very robust oversight, though that oversight could take a variety of forms. And I also think the government does need to be more transparent here.
Can you be transparent and secret at the same time? Is there a balance that works out there? We heard John Brennan talking about wanting optimum transparency and optimum secrecy.
Well, I think he's right in saying that there is a dilemma here. There are operational and diplomatic reasons why you'd want to maintain a certain level of secrecy, especially to protect intelligence sources and methods and perhaps the cooperation from some allies and partners who don't want it widely known that they're working with us. On the other hand, we are a democracy premised on checks and balances, including an informed electorate that holds officials accountable. At least that's generally what we believe. I would take the view that even if the law, and remember, the Justice Department white paper here is a legal
document. We're up
against
a break, Matthew. Forgive me. We'll come right back and look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the law and ethics of death by drone, U.S. drone killings, including of Americans, and the debate that's broken out hot and very publicly last week after years of drone killings escalating year after year, particularly under the Obama administration. Julian Barnes is with us, Pentagon correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Matthew Waxman is here. He's professor of law at Columbia University. Jamil Jaffer is here, director of the ACLU Center for Democracy. He's been in the thick of this. Julian, remind us of the numbers here. And I know that these are often put together, not by the government, certainly released not by the government, but lots of people have tracked this. How many strikes? What's the escalation? How many deaths? How many civilian deaths?
Well, the numbers vary. The Wall Street Journal count is about 2,000. Others have used the count.
2,000 what?
2,000 people killed in the drone strikes, mainly in Pakistan. Others have used the count 3,000 or 4,000 for the number of people killed. So the reports are different, and the reports on civilian casualties vary quite a lot. And that's
from what to what?
Well, Senator Feinstein said the annual figures, I believe she said, were in the single digits last year and the year before.
But nobody who's tracking has a number in the single digits.
They've no. I mean,
hundreds
we're
or more.
Well, some people have in the – yes, I guess in the hundreds, yeah. Some strikes up to 40 individuals. Part of the reason is we have these strikes called signature strikes where the government does not know exactly who they're striking, but the pattern of life, the observation of what they've seen leads them to believe they're militants. These are generally military age males. Those strikes have been curtailed in recent months, but during the height of the drone strikes in Pakistan, they accounted for a number of them. And those were people the government considered militants, but outside groups said, hey, they don't know who they are. They could just be innocents.
And deaths of Americans at this point, known deaths?
Well, we have Anwar Awlaki, and we have his son, and then we have the editor of Insight magazine. So I believe that's three. Is that correct?
We'll take it from you, John Brennan, last week saying, look, we're not just raining these things down willy-nilly. Here he was before the Senate committee.
I think there's a misimpression on the part of some American people who believe that we take strikes to punish terrorists for past transgressions. Nothing could be further from the truth. We only take such actions as a last resort to save lives when there's no other alternative to taking an action that's going to mitigate that threat.
But still, the numbers have gone up and up on a very steady curve. People in both parties, uneasy to say the least about that. Here was Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, Republican, saying that, you know, any American citizen that goes overseas and takes up arms against the United States needs to stand trial for treason. But uneasy about just the swift decision of what would happen there, of drone kills.
I think you should be tried for treason. If you're an American citizen, you go overseas and you take up arms, I'm probably for executing you, but I would want to hear the evidence. I would want to have a judge and a jury. It can be fairly swift, but there needs to be a trial for treason.
There needs to be a trial for treason. And there, of course, has been nothing of the sort. Matthew Waxman, here, ACLU and others have worked to get documents public. New York Times tried to get the Justice Department to disclose the memo providing legal justification for the targeted killing of Al-Awlaki. And the judge who supported the government in keeping that closed, this is Colleen McMahon, a federal judge, but she said, I can find no way around the thicket of laws and precedents that effectively allow the executive branch of our government to proclaim as perfectly lawful certain actions that seem on their face incompatible with our Constitution and laws, while keeping the reasons for their conclusion a secret. She said, the Alice in Wonderland nature of this pronouncement is not lost on me, of her own pronouncement right there. I mean, it's not very open, Matthew. Is it in the spirit of our Constitution?
Well, this is the point I was trying to get at before, which is that even if the government is on strong legal grounds, not only in its policy and practices, but also in maintaining secrecy, legality does not necessarily always mean that something is ethically correct, nor does it mean that it's wise. And in this case, I think both ethics and wisdom do demand greater transparency than we've seen from the government so far, or at least greater oversight by Congress or independent bodies. I think this kind of oversight can take a variety of forms, but I do think it's important from both an ethical standpoint and a policy or strategic standpoint that targeted strikes be used very judiciously.
Why do ethics demand more oversight? Why does wisdom?
Well, as to ethics, I think as you touched on earlier, as a democracy premised on the idea of checks and balances and an informed electorate where we hold our officials accountable for their conduct, this is an issue of major public policy import. And I think the idea that a policy of this sort would be conducted in secrecy leads justifiably to a lot of skepticism.
But you were in the Bush administration where there was real and present danger was obvious and then proclaimed, and a lot of things were done without a full public conversation. Is it different now?
Well, I think that was a mistake on the Bush's part, on the Bush administration's part. I think one reason why public opinion domestically, internationally, as well as judicial resistance escalated during the Bush administration was because it didn't do a good enough job of being public and transparent about its policy, its reasoning, et cetera. And I think the Obama administration has learned some of that lesson, and it can go even farther. It's been quite incremental, I think, in its disclosures.
Jamil Jaffer, there was John Brennan. He's up to be chief of the CIA. The CIA has been running this, and there's some debate about whether that should go to the Pentagon, where there's more oversight. But he told the senators last week that he never used the word drones, but he said, look, I stay up. It keeps me up at night worrying about the safety of the American people, and we need these extraordinary means or words to that effect. What about that argument that there is such a threat that we can't have all kinds of oversight and, things that would bring delays in here? We need this, Jamil.
Well, I don't think anybody's making the argument that – or very many people are making the argument that the administration or the government should never be using lethal force ever. The question is, are the limits on the use of lethal force the right limits? And is there sufficient oversight of the government's decisions to use lethal force? And I think that there's every argument in favor of more oversight than exists now. If you just look at our experience with Guantanamo, for example, you know, there were hundreds of men who were initially labeled the worst of the worst. I think that was Secretary Rumsfeld's phrase. And it turned out that even the Bush administration eventually realized that some of the people they had labeled the worst of the worst turned out not to be. And in fact, some of them weren't threats at all. They were detained on the basis of unreliable or mistaken evidence. And the same thing will inevitably happen and has already happened with drone strikes. And especially where you're talking about something irreversible, like the use of lethal force, it's crucial that you get the answer right in the first instance. And right now, we've got a system that does not assure that we get the right answers at all.
But this white paper
says
there's
been a lot of talk about.
This white paper says
informed high level. Sorry, go ahead.
The white paper says informed high level officials will, you know what they need to know and decide for us, and is what I read from it, and that should be okay.
Well, we don't, you know, as I think Julian said earlier, we don't even have that, you know, if you want to wiretap somebody's phone, we require more oversight than exists right now for the use of lethal force. So, you know, we have that for a reason. We have that because executive officials make mistakes. Sometimes they don't act in good faith. And even if you trust the people whose fingers are on the trigger right now, those aren't the people whose fingers are going to be on the trigger 4 years from now or 8 years from now. And you have to build a system of checks and balances that accounts for the possibility that the person in that seat is not trustworthy. I'm not saying that the Obama administration should be trusted with this power. I don't think they should. But even if you think that they're trustworthy, they're not the ones whose fingers are going to be on the trigger in 10 or 20 years. And you can imagine, you know, if another country asserted the authority that we're asserting right now, if China or Iran, for example, said, well, we too want to have a worldwide program of targeted killing aimed at people who don't present imminent threats, and we too are going to carry out that program without even acknowledging that we are exercising the authority. In other words, we're going to kill people in secret without presenting evidence to any court. You can imagine how we would respond to that, and we would be right in responding in that way. The only reason we have this power, the only reason I think that many Americans have been willing to invest this power in our government right now is that they trust the Obama administration. And again, I think that's not a good reason to put this kind of power in the presidency, because the next president may not be somebody you trust.
Some of those same Democrats who were up in arms over measures taken under George W. Bush. Here was former Michigan Governor Democrat Jennifer Granholm on Current TV on Thursday saying, oh, you know, it depends who's in office.
We trust the president. And if this were Bush, I think that we would all be more up in arms because we wouldn't trust that he would strike in a very targeted way and try to minimize damage.
Well, trust here, trust there. But in this country, it's supposed to be based on law and the Constitution. Ed's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Ed, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. My question, I guess, is maybe not so much on the legality, although I certainly think that our weaponized drone policy is both illegal and immoral. We refer to Article 51 of the UN Charter as part of the justification, but then we don't fulfill our obligations even under that. But really my question to the guests is, what do they think about the effectiveness of weaponized drone use, especially in Pakistan, where 74%, according to a Pew poll, 74% of the population of Pakistan views the United States as an enemy, with the predominant reason being our drone attacks killing civilians there.
Yeah, lots of people up in arms there. If I may ask you, Ed, why do you think it's immoral? Just in your words.
It's, you know, the just war concept of Christianity says that you don't kill innocent civilians. And that is what we do, and signature strikes sort of blur over this idea that we are specifically, surgically, like a laser beam, targeting only high-level terrorists. Yeah, I mean, the evidence is just not there.
Yes, and that's pretty much agreed on. Ed, I appreciate your call. We're looking at drones, the law, and American values in this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Julian Barnes, I think Ed's correct in citing the opinion polls out of Pakistan, the rather widespread, I don't know if fury is too strong a word for a populace there watching drones come down. He asks about the overall effectiveness of the use of drones, Julian.
There's no question that people in Pakistan oppose this, that we have sort of implicit or tacit permission by the Pakistan government to do this, but not an overt permission. You know, this is sort of why some people in the Pentagon are pushing for this program to move from the CIA to the military. You could then explain individual strikes. You could lay out the evidence. The government, after a strike, could say, this is what we did, this is why we did it.
Why can't the CIA do that?
Well, because it's a covert program, and in their minds, and if they publicly discuss this, then they will create a precedent where other covert programs they feel they have to discuss.
But they come out every time and talk about the successful strikes when they claim them on al-Qaeda leadership.
That's right. I mean, they don't you'll notice that people do it on background. They hedge, like John Brennan not mentioning the word drones, whereas a military accounting can be more clear, more open. It's easier to get some more information in many cases, not all cases.
Well, I appreciate that view. Sam in Woburn, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Well, I can only describe this whole conversation as absolutely Orwellian in the use of doublespeak. But having said that, you can't have it both ways. If you believe in the rule of law, you can have extrajudicial assassinations on the whim of a person. And I don't trust Obama. I don't trust any person to decide, be judge, jury, and executioner. It's just flat out wrong, and on all measures, it just doesn't work. And I'd leave my guest this parting thought. I'm sure you've heard it a million times.
Mm-hmm.
How would we feel if a foreign government decided they have to take out some enemies to their country, and parenthetically, they kill 28 innocent civilians in the act?
In the United States or anywhere else in the world, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we'd be having this calm, measured discussion. It's lunacy. It's Orwellian.
Orwellian, if you believe in law, it can't be done like this. Jamil, how about it? I mean, we're hearing about secret law, and I've heard that described as just a straight-up oxymoron. If it's secret, so the public can't judge it, can't weigh it, and these rationales have not been made public, can it really be legitimate law? And what about the Orwellian claim there about the whole conversation nationally?
Right. I mean, I do think that there's something Orwellian about this, and the idea that the government should be carrying out these kinds of killings on the basis of secret legal memos and without even acknowledging that specific strikes took place. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Anwar al-Awlaki. He was the guy who was on the government's kill list. But you know, as you mentioned, Tom, at the beginning of the show, his 16-year-old son was killed too, 2 weeks later in a separate strike. And his 16-year-old son has never been alleged to have been associated with terrorist organizations or anything like that. But the government hasn't explained that strike. They haven't explained why they killed this 16-year-old American. They haven't even acknowledged that they did it. And that's really a pretty stunning thing, that the government thinks it has the authority to kill Americans without acknowledging that it's doing so. So I think that your caller is exactly right. I don't think we would be having this kind of calm, measured conversation if some other country were asserting the authority. I think that Jennifer Granholm was also right, that we wouldn't be having this calm, measured conversation if it were the Bush administration asserting this authority. And that should make us think twice about our readiness to give this power to the Obama administration.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the law and ethics of death by drone. U.S. drone killings, including of Americans, And the big debate that has maybe finally broken out over this, how it should all be handled. In a few minutes, we'll also look at the word out of Rome today that Pope Benedict XVI will leave office, will retire. First time in centuries that has happened, a living pope walking away from that post. Jamil Jaffer is with us from the ACLU. Matthew Waxman from Columbia University, fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Julian Barnes from the Wall Street Journal is here. Senators pushing late last week and over the weekend for maybe some kind of court to oversee the U.S. drone program, drone killings. On CNN's State of the Union on Sunday, former Defense Secretary Robert Gates said a panel overseeing the drone program should be considered going forward.
Whether it's a panel of three judges or one judge or something that would give the American people confidence that there was, in fact, a compelling case to launch an attack against an American citizen, I think just as an independent confirmation or affirmation, if you will, is something worth giving serious consideration to.
Get some kind of oversight in here. Think about that, says Robert Gates right there. Jamil, Matthew, Julian, lots of response from our listeners. I want to give you just a sampling. Drew in Georgia says, preemption is a tyrant's best friend. It's ridiculous, atrocious, reprehensible. It's got to stop. So there is one view. On the other hand, here's AC, who's sort of going back and forth with it. It says, in every sci-fi movie, it's the bad guy oppressing the masses with drones. This feels like we're the bad guys. Yet throughout history, security has a dark side the average person doesn't want to know about. I really don't know where I stand on this. I don't want to decide. It wants to be convinced one way or another, AC writes. And then Jeff says, is shooting bin Laden in the head better than assassination by drone? Jamil, what about, you know, there's AC who's going, he's on the fence. You know, it looks bad to him, but he's not sure. AC says, forget it. But Jeff says, you know, is it better to go in? Navy SEALs in harm's way. Family died in that too. You know, what was it? One of his wives who died and more. Describe the difference in legal terms for us.
Well, I think that there are some hard questions here, but there are two things that I think should be relatively easy. One is transparency, and you know, there's so much more that the government could release about the program. About civilian casualties, about the legal justifications, about the identities of the people who've been killed. And that kind of information might help people better evaluate the ethics and the wisdom of the policy. And the second thing is some form of oversight, because even if you think that the government needs to have this authority in some small number of cases, even if you think that there are people out there who are so dangerous that we need to essentially change the constitutional structure we've had in place for 200 years, even if you think all of that, what is the argument against some form of judicial review? Maybe there's an argument that judicial review shouldn't happen before the fact, if you believe that the government's authority is limited, as I believe, to situations in which there's a true imminent threat, then prior judicial review, I think, is infeasible by definition. There's just not time to go to a judge. But that doesn't rule out the possibility of after-the-fact judicial review. And obviously, there's something, you know, unsatisfying about after-the-fact review, because you can't resurrect the person who's been killed unlawfully. But on the other hand, after-the-fact judicial review can create a legal framework in which future strikes are or are not carried out, and that's an important thing.
Would you settle for that? At the ACLU, we kind of expect you to be the, you know, all or nothing guys here. Would you settle for after the fact they're dead, an American citizen laying on the ground somewhere?
Well, the reason I don't think of it as settling, because we don't agree with the administration that they have the authority to use lethal force against people who present continuing rather than truly imminent threats. If you know, even in a domestic law enforcement context, the police have the authority to use lethal force against people who present truly imminent threats without going to a judge first to present evidence.
Yep.
Right? If somebody's running down the street waving a gun around, the police can use lethal force if they have to. And there is judicial review, but the judicial judicial review takes place after the fact.
Yeah.
And that's the same, you know, that's the same kind of framework that might work here. And in fact, we have a case already. We've brought a lawsuit on behalf of the three American citizens who were killed in Yemen in 2011. We've brought a case asking for that kind of after the fact judicial review. But the administration has argued that the question of whether the government's actions were lawful is a political question that judges don't have the authority to decide. So, you know, we're proposing it, but the administration is resisting it.
Julian, what about the timing of these things? You're at the Pentagon. Would there be time? You know, they say these are carefully considered strikes. Often they're planned for a long time. Would there be time to go to a judge in advance? I mean, maybe that shouldn't even matter under the Constitution. But just practically speaking, Julian.
For some of them, the answer would be yes. I mean, for a lot of these, they're developing a case over days and weeks. And as long as you win at the right time, you could in many cases have time to do it. Like Mokhtar Belmokhtar in Mali, they've been since the Algerian hostage taking, they've been developing a case against him. Now we have reported that they put him on a kill list. Well, there would have been time to do at least some review by a judge.
Is this the guy who did the Algerian refinery takeover?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And in other cases, it would be more imminent, like Jamil was saying, and you wouldn't be able to do it. Now, the problem is this is likely to be a secret court. People aren't going to see this. You'd only know that a judge has reviewed it, but you wouldn't be able to see many of the results of what the judge did. So it's not clear that it would address all the problems people are hoping it will.
I mean, a judge could really feel, I hate the metaphor, but under the gun here to just give the approval if the White House is saying, we got to do this right now.
That's right. I mean, it's not actually clear that the judge would not have as much access to the intelligence or the raw intelligence that the government would have, or some people in the government would have. It's not clear how independent they would be. I mean, on the other hand, it is an outsider. It is somebody who...
At least somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go to Anthony Sumter, South Carolina. Anthony, you're on the air. Hi, Anthony. Are you there? We'll just have to let that go. We're almost out of time here. Matthew Waxman, what do you see unfolding here? The Obama administration has, we heard the president talk about getting a legal framework and working with Congress to do it, but they have been very, very reluctant to really lay out their rationale. Is it time for more transparency? You were in the Bush administration. You look at this one, look ahead. Should we just bite the bullet and do it now? Talk about it all publicly, openly.
I do think it's time for some more transparency. I do think it's time for to think through a greater, more robust oversight mechanisms. I've been a bit confused by the Obama administration's position on this, both with respect to targeting issues and detention. The president has said he'd like to work with Congress on a legal architecture, but then the administration hasn't really come forward with a specific proposal or seemed very interested in working with Congress on this. But I do think from a legal, a political, and a strategic standpoint, it is important. It is important that we put these policies on a more sustainable foundation.
We're talking calmly, but it's a big deal, and to many, an urgent deal. Jamil Jaffer, do you see this administration coming around?
I don't think they're going to come around on their own. I think that they've made that pretty clear. But maybe there is the prospect now for a more engaged Congress, and I think that there's the possibility of more engaged courts. There are two cases now pending in D.C., one in the district court, which is a constitutional challenge, and one in the appeals court, which is a transparency challenge. There's a case pending in New York. It's another transparency challenge. So there are outside forces that may compel the administration to address things that it has not been that enthusiastic about addressing.
Hey, Julian, we just have a few seconds here. Maybe the CIA will give it up. What about the chances of that and more transparency just by being in the Pentagon without the CIA in charge, Julian?
It's certainly a possibility. Mr. Panetta, as he departs, says he wants it. Reports have said John Brennan is in favor of that. So perhaps there's opportunity for that.
Watch this space. Julian Barnes of the Wall Street Journal, you're terrific. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Matthew Waxman, in the Bush administration, George W., in many positions, now professor of law, co-chair of the Program on Law and National Security at Columbia University. Matthew Waxman, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Jamil Jaffer, director of the ACLU's Center for Democracy. Jamil Jaffer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, Pope Benedict will step down at the end of the month. This is On Point. Big news, a big surprise from the Vatican today as Pope Benedict XVI announced he would resign by the end of this month after just 8 years as Pope. He'll be the first Pope to step down in, well, we're seeing conflicting reports, but maybe 600 years. We want to look at why he's going and where that leaves the papacy and the Catholic Church. With us now from South Bend, Indiana, is Scott Appleby, professor of history, director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, a big American interpreter of the Vatican. Scott Appleby, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
How long has it been? We're seeing back to Celestine in the 1300s or 13th century even, or I don't know. Do you know how long it's been since a pope said, I've got to go?
The 15th century, it was Pope Gregory the 12th, who actually resigned to end what was called the Great Schism in the Church, where there were rival candidates for the papacy, and to end that, he resigned. Pope Celestine V stepped down after a very short time as pope because he never felt himself worthy of being the pope, and he retired to a monastery.
So 600 years since a pope did this to avoid a schism in the church, Pope Benedict XVI's rationale seems far short of a schism. Why is he really doing it?
Well, I have to say that the pope deserves praise for the courage and the foresight. I think he's aware that the job is getting to be too much for him. He's 85 years old. I would take at face value what he said today. I don't have the stamina or the capability physically or mentally to keep up with the demands of the job. And there are a lot of men who would not admit that and step down. And it's, I think, welcome news that he's wise and, frankly, humble enough to do so.
That's perhaps to be admired, but is there something changing in the Vatican that would permit this? I mean, there have been surely plenty of popes in all those centuries who, before they died as pope, were infirm, maybe in the extreme. Even John Paul II, you know, had lots of health problems, but didn't step down. Is there something about the people around the pope this time that, I don't know, they're not up to it, or they don't want to do it, or a new attitude at the Vatican about a pope who's losing capacity?
Benedict XVI is both a theologian and a historian of the Church, and you're right. There have been times in many pontificates, even in the modern era, where a pope has been infirm and his immediate supervisors have taken over, essentially, sometimes not really holding up the legacy of that pope. I think Benedict is aware of that. Also, it must be said, this has not been the most orderly curia, or orderly staff at least, papal staff, and I think he's aware of that. It's time for new management, and to turn over in his failing years, as he would expect them to be, the leadership and the administration of the church to his subordinates would not seem to be a wise thing. So he's breaking precedent, but I think he's doing it thoughtfully because I think he's aware it would be better to have a new administration in place to carry things forward. Remember that he's appointed over half of the current cardinals who will elect the next pope, and the other set of cardinals are those who voted for him, many of them at least, in the first place. So he's ensuring a kind of continuity by stepping down now.
Is there any kind of theological problem with the pope stepping down shy of his own death?
There's no theological problem. He would revert to being a cardinal, but he's 85, so he would not be allowed to vote and would not attend the conclave to elect the next pope. But theologically, there's nothing indicating that he must serve for life.
The Vatican says he plans to live in a cloistered monastery after his resignation. What's your interpretation of why the curia, the papal staff, has not, as you say, not been the most orderly under this pope? Is it something about Benedict's management style or something about the church's situation these days?
I think both. Benedict is a theologian. He's an academic. He's a professor. We professors are not naturally given to administration. I can tell you that. We do what we need to, and there are some very gifted administrators in the academy. But Benedict's a theologian. He has not been the best manager of the papal staff or the broader bureaucracy. It's a challenge for even a very good and strong manager, because it is an ancient institution with its own sinecures and pockets, and it's diverse internally. It's not a lean, mean machine that you can just command at one's whim. So he's had his struggles. There have been scandals. There has been the famous this case of the butler stealing information about mm-hmm. various scandals and making it public because he was motivated by the Holy Spirit. There've been enough gaffes and missteps that he's not going to go down in history as the best organized or administrative pope. He's been a very good teacher. He's produced three quite brilliant encyclicals tying together Catholic social teaching with the depth of the theological tradition and bringing those together around a focus of charity and compassion and love for the poor and the church's duties to the world. So he's been very good in what his strength is, namely to think as a theologian. A lot of theologians will disagree with him. He's been also someone who's cracked down on dissent in the church. Mm-hmm. He did that as prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and certainly as pope. So it's been a little bit his way or the highway, but one expects something of that from a pope. But as an administrator, he's not been outstanding.
We've got just half a minute here. The stakes in choosing Pope Benedict XVI's successor, how do you see them, Scott Appleby?
I think they're high. The church needs what the current Pope, Benedict XVI, calls a new evangelization. It needs to reach out more broadly, globally. It's facing problems with the priesthood, the lingering and continuing effects of the sexual abuse scandal, the need to once again renew the global and international character of the church, the need to evangelize young people, competition from Pentecostals, and in certain parts of the world, from Islam. There are a variety of challenges facing the church, and it really needs bold, energetic leadership.
Scott Appleby, joining us from South Bend, Indiana, professor of history at Notre Dame. Always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us today, Scott.
Thank you, Tom.
Tomorrow, in this hour, we'll look at how the NRA conquered America's gun debate and where it stands in the debate right now. Join us. Thanks for being here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.